I'm reminded that I am supposed to announce to the group that I have no conflicts. And our last presenter is Burton, is it Cowgill?
Cowgill.
And his presentation is on the question whether we're meeting the health and social service needs of HIV-infected parents and their children. It's a qualitative study.
Good morning. So I'm here today to talk with you about our findings from a qualitative study where we interviewed HIV-infected parents and their family members. Before I begin, though, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Laura Bogart, Rosalie Corona, Tamani Coker, Gary Ryan, and Mark Schuster. And we also have no relationships to disclose. So to provide a little background, as we heard from our first presenter today, that we're seeing increases in the number of parents who are HIV positive and that have children for a number of reasons. And these HIV-infected parents must manage both their needs as a patient and their responsibilities as a parent. Literature tells us that these parents have both physical and mental health service needs, in addition to social support services that help them address financial obligations, insurance coverage, and legal issues. Many of these services are available through programs like Ryan White that support that are available for eligible parents, typically in low-income groups. As many of us probably know, Ryan White is sort of a payer of last resort for a wide range of services, and we will come and speak to that a little bit later in the presentation. We also know that children of HIV-infected parents are at risk for emotional and behavioral problems and may benefit from mental health services. So there are two main objectives for this study. The first was to identify both the met and unmet health and social service needs as described by HIV-infected parents and their family members. In addition, we wanted to understand the barriers faced by these parents and their family members when they attempted to access both health and social services. I'm going to speak a little bit about our methods. We used semi-structured interviews that were conducted with HIV-infected parents, their minor children, adult children, and caregivers from across the United States. Caregivers were either a spouse, a partner, a grandparent, or a friend. The parents were a subsample of participants from the HIV Costs and Services Utilization Study, or HCSUS. HCSUS was a national probability sample of adults in care for HIV. And most of these parents were recruited prior to 1995, so had been living with HIV for a long period of time. Parents were asked about the services they used and the services they did not use and why, and we also explored the barriers to utilization of these services. Children were asked if they talked to a counselor or spoke with other mental health professionals and also other services that they used. We used content analyses to identify the major themes that, brought up by both the parents and children that related to met and unmet service needs. The interviews were transcribed, and then the transcripts were coded by two research assistants, and disagreements with recoding were resolved by the first author. To tell you a little bit about our population, we had 33 HIV-infected parents. Almost three-quarters were mothers. The mean age was 44 years. Race ethnicity broke down with 48% African American, 30% white or other. We had one American Indian family in the other group, and then 20% Latino. Our income data came from the baseline HCSUS survey, so this was in $1995, but a majority of the families had incomes of less than $25,000 then. Our exposure risk group was almost half through heterosexual contact, 27% through intravenous drug use, and then 12% of men having sex with men or other. We interviewed 27 minor children, with the youngest being 9 years old, 19 adult children between the ages of 18 to 30. So many of these children were young children when their parents were diagnosed with HIV and had grown into adulthood at this time. Of our caregivers, 73% were a spouse partner, and then 13% were a grandparent, and 13% were a friend. And these caregivers specifically either assisted the parent with their care needs or took care of the children or both. So parents dealing with HIV, as I said before, must balance being a parent and being a patient. And before I get into some of our specific findings on the unmet health and social service needs of these individuals, I ask you to take into context of them addressing their own health needs and then the challenges of being a parent. And some of the quotes that I present here, I think, nicely illustrate what they were dealing with. So here an HIV-positive mother explains her reaction at her time of diagnosis. She said, "You know, I was thinking about my daughter. What am I going to do? My daughter's little. She needs her mother. So I went to the hospital. The only thing I was thinking about was my kid. Who'll be there with my kid? Another mother explains coping with the physical and emotional aspects of being a parent. HIV does affect your ability to be a parent. If not physically, it does emotionally, because you'll have a tendency to let them get away with things." So here are some of the main themes that came up in terms of parents reporting a range of both health and social service needs. They identified medications, both antiretroviral treatments for their HIV and antidepressants to deal with mental health issues. Pretty much all parents and families identified mental health counseling as an important need. Case management, income and housing assistance, help with chores around the home and food assistance, as well as transportation, getting to appointments, and legal assistance for things such as guardianship planning and custody issues. So now I'm going to speak about some of our selected results on our major themes. So parents reported problems with insurance coverage and costs as barriers to having access to needed HIV and antidepressant medications. In this particular case, this mother had recently come into some money from a family member who had deceased, and she decided to buy a home for her family so they had a stable place to live. But in doing so, shares, "Now no more meds. They didn't give me any more prescriptions, nothing. I have 100% copay. And I'll show you my little credit card. It says 100% copay. I have to pay for everything." And she was told if she wanted to get the coverage back, she needed to sell the home and have her family basically back out, living in an unstable living environment. In regards to accessing mental health services, we saw that most parents reported having access to some sort of therapy, whether it be group or individual therapy. But some shared with us reasons why they chose not to access these services. Some had to do with stigma, both of acknowledging themselves being HIV positive in the community, as well as going and receiving mental health services themselves. And others talked about their individual coping styles and that they didn't need these services. So here an HIV-positive father shared his thoughts about group therapy. "I don't believe any services can help you. I don't believe I can sit down and listen to someone else's problems when I have my own cross to bear." Here below there, an HIV-positive mother talks about going to a clinic for therapy. "Some people are embarrassed to go to these places. I mean, even though they're public places, you know, I saw you going in there. Something's wrong with you. That really has been a main concern for me, and that is why I shied away from it," meaning getting help with their mental health needs. Most but not all of our families were eligible to receive assistance through Ryan White programs. As many of us know, these services can include transportation, family services, medical services, housing, nutrition, dental rehabilitation, and home health. And our families really talked about the importance of these services and how they relied on them. Here a father reports, "The Ryan White, I've used the energy assistance. I've used the emergency food pantry that they have. Food services and transportation. I get a monthly bus pass to ride the bus or the train to my doctor's appointments." An important aspect of Ryan White is the case management component, where case managers are provided by a licensed social worker. The social worker helps individuals find and use services in the community, and can assist with education, information, and assistance, referrals and linkage to available services, advocacy, and support. And in our sample, our parents that use case management really had great experiences with that. Here a mother reports, "My case manager helps me like with housing situations if I need someone to go with me, like face-to-face, or accompany me to an appointment if I need paperwork to be filled out." In the second quote, this case manager went even above sort of the normal call of duty in helping the mother disclose her HIV status to her daughter. She says, my case manager helped me disclose to my child, and it was extremely supportive. I will never forget her. She would make home visits and refer me to any type of services that I needed. In some of our families, though, we saw that they either did not use case management because they chose not to or were not aware of these services. And for these families without case management, they faced additional obstacles, such as dealing with bureaucracy and paperwork for services, just not being aware of the services that were out there and available to them, and dealing with stigma when they did try to access these services on their own. Here the wife of an HIV-positive father shares, the housing is ridiculous. I know we can probably go down to the aid services and get moving fees or rent or security. For what you have to deal with, it's not worth it. When you have to ask for help and be belittled and feel that way, that feeling is not worth it. So we also looked at the children's needs, and these findings were reported by both the parent and caregivers as well as the children themselves. And we found that a majority of the children reported using mental health services, whether it be individual or family counseling, whether it be school-based or faith-based. We found that some of the children, though, were hesitant to talk to a mental health provider, and these children did describe feelings of being isolated at times and not having someone to talk to. Some of this also had to do with disclosure issues and the stigma that might be associated with others finding out about their parents' HIV status and how that might impact them, even though they themselves are not infected with HIV. So here was a couple quotes of children and their experiences with counseling services. So the 16-year-old son of an HIV-positive mother describes his experience. Well, after I talk with her, I feel a whole lot better. We talk about how I'm doing in school and my family, anything good or bad during the week. The adult daughter of an HIV-positive mother thought back and recalled her experiences of the family going together to individual therapy. It was kind of weird because we were all in therapy. Mom would see her therapist, my brother would see one, and I would see another. We would all drive there, and it was like this awkward silence on the ride there and the ride home. It was just very tense and weird. So to summarize some of our key findings, we saw the parents described unmet needs with access to medications due to both limitations of insurance coverage and costs. Parents without an advocate, such as a case manager, described more difficulty with accessing needed support services, like for housing, food, or income assistance. We saw in many of the instances that perceived stigma and personal preferences prevented some parents from accessing available services. We did see many children were utilizing mental health services and did describe benefiting from them. Some of the implications of our findings. Families with an HIV-infected parent may benefit from someone to help integrate their medical treatment and social service needs, someone who might be aware of all of their unmet needs. Case managers may be able to help address some of the social service needs, but might not be as knowledgeable about their health service needs. Some preliminary research about the benefits of having a treatment advocate has shown that treatment advocates may be more equipped to address unmet medical needs. Continued research and interventions aimed at overcoming actual and perceived stigma faced by HIV-infected parents and their affected family members may increase access to needed services. In healthcare, social service providers, policymakers, and advocates may need to ensure that comprehensive health and social services continue to be available through programs such as Ryan White, especially during these hard economic times. I would like to thank our funders, the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development, and the Centers for Disease Control, as well as our research assistants who spent many hours going through our transcripts and really learning the lives of our families, both the parents and children, and doing all the coding and really getting this material out so we can all share it. And I provide my contact information if you have any follow-up questions. Thank you.
In a very short period of time, we just heard four different presentations of similar topic areas. Those of you like me who work in HIV healthcare undoubtedly struggle with, on a daily basis, patient retention issues and looking at service utilization, identified needs, the cost of services, the impacts of HIV on the family, the uninfected children, and their service needs. So this covered a pretty broad area of service utilization, expense, and needs, and it did so in a succinct, statistically relevant time period. And it covered both examples from the East Coast and the West Coast, so I think it's got a breadth and depth to it in terms of the panel. Before I ask the audience for questions, just a reminder, some of you may have arrived late. On Tuesday evening, the HIV-AIDS section, who is the sponsor of this session, is hosting its annual social event that will be located in the Convention Center from 8 to 10 in room 31B. There will be plenty of food. The event is free, although it is a cash bar, and I hope that many of you will be able to join us. Now, questions?
Because the high utilization can go both ways, because I have seen studies which say that children having a lot of issues with their mental and physical needs, so they may utilize for that reason. And the second reason could be like defensive mothering. Also, I have seen a lot of qualitative analysis where the children or the parents, they think too much about their kids, and they start providing them with all kinds of healthcare services so as to just to make them sure that they are good. So it can. It's like it's a concern as a requirement. It can go both ways. Maybe that's why, like, I'm a PhD student. I'm doing my dissertation on the primary collection data where I've used the secondary MAPS data, but I want to see actually what's happening with them. And maybe a few years down the line, you may see another report which actually says why they are doing so. And that could be it. Could be endless research study, but it's very pertinent for us to know why it is happening.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Dr. Riley, I found your study thought-provoking because I'm wondering, in looking at allocating resources, especially in a bi-white context, would it make more sense to put more effort into keeping people insured than to putting the resources into providing, say, you know, direct primary care?
That's a good question.
That's a good question.
Keeping people insured rather than providing care. Well, I would say that, you know, with insurance, it's not just primary care. I mean, the insurance is providing a lot of services, and it's, I would say that, I can't say whether it would be better to put it in insurance or just providing the services, but I would say that insurance is more than just getting primary care, that there's all these other things. And so I, just off the cuff, I would say insurance is, putting the resources toward insurance would be a good thing. But I mean, both your idea is a good one too. That would be a great comparison. Which is better, just the care or having the insurance? I'm not sure.
Yes, sir.
Issue in 2008 in the United States. If so, how do you
that I would agree with you that stigma plays a role, and again, I share it with the vulnerable principles and characteristics. One of the things we could say is a reason for people not identifying the transmission risk could just be based on stigma. I don't want to say what orientation I am. That's a stigma on its own, even apart from the stigma of HIV. And you see, like we see in the study, we found that those who fail to report their risk are one of the groups that you should focus on because it's a red flag. If you're not willing to talk about who they are or how they got that transmission, they're more likely to drop out of care. So I agree with you, although it sounds weird in 2008 with all the information that we have, stigma would still be an issue, but I can talk from an experience that I had doing an internship in Allendale County in 2006. And I went to that county, I walked in the community health center, and I talked with people providing HIV services, and they told me a story about a young boy who was diagnosed with HIV, and he was living with his family, and in 2006, they made him eat out of paper cups. They made him drink out of paper cups. He made his food after the family's food had been made. Now, if you told me that story from 1985, I would say yes, but in 2006, I would say no, but it exists. And this becomes a problem because we assume we've provided so much information, we've done education, we've done communication, everything is fine. No, it's not. People don't want to talk about the problems. And that becomes an issue because even if you don't say it, I can feel it, I can sense it, that you don't want to deal with it. So yes, that would be an important factor.
Yes.
A lot on this, because it comes up a lot. If you fill out a risk sheet, you should be able to go through
Yes, sir.
It's an interesting discussion about stigma, and I totally agree with that. But I think there are, I work in the South Bronx, and certainly if I think about the patients I have who are in and out of care, it's usually the comorbid things that are going on, homelessness, drug use, uncontrolled diabetes, poverty, and 101 things, but it's, and stigma is one of them. There are a lot of other factors that come into play, but above and beyond insurance, I need to think we're all in there.
Yes, I think that also valid, a very valid argument. It depends on what the need is, why they're coming in and why they're coming out of care. Yes.
Yeah. I think that's true, but I think especially though it doesn't work in more rural parts or in the southern parts of this country, geography is also a major factor because everybody knows your truck.
Yeah.
And they want to know why you're parked in the health department parking lot. That's an issue. If you know if you're male, you're not going in for WIC. Yeah. So it becomes, you know, another reason not to. And that's the big issue we have in North Carolina, because they're copying the Nashville model of this one centralized point of care, you know, all manual services, and everybody says, yeah, that would be great to have that because it would, you know, be more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. Then you get this immediate pushback saying, I ain't going near that neighborhood if that bully's there, because everyone will be in my business and will know what's going on with me. So there's not a silver bullet answer here, but the stigma plays a large role.
And also just to comment on the last gentleman's point that there are a lot of other issues going on. I didn't have a lot of time to get into this in such a short presentation, but just to let you know, some of the confounders of insurance that we did find were things like cocaine withdrawal, and so yes, addiction is a big deal here, and that confounded the associations between insurance and health services use. So there are a lot of things going on in this age, and but housing status and those types of things.
And there was something that I didn't mention that, that was the finding about whites being more likely to be not in care compared to blacks. And while I don't have definite proof, we made postulations about why that could be. And the things we talked about, and it took a lot of back and forth, was that, again, based on proportion, this is a condition where in South Carolina, the minority population in this case are whites. In HIV, you have 7% more African American blacks. And the one unique characteristic you have across board is poverty. So the poor state, everybody, it's not a real high income state. So you're probably accessing round white care or you're accessing public health programs. Well, this is one of the things we talked about based on the culture. So if you're a white person and you walk into the healthcare system in your local area and 8 out of every 10 people there, African American with HIV/AIDS, you might be less likely to go there. Your option would be to have private insurance, which you don't have. So you're probably not going to be accessing care like you should. And then that gets layered upon when you have a lot of interventions trying to get traditional minority populations into care, assuming that whites have access to care. And, you know, we went as far as putting something that you might actually have a numerical population effect, which is basically that the systemic disparities we talk about, if you actually switch the numbers, so you have the white population actually a minority in the condition, they could also suffer the same problems with access to care that every other person suffers, and that's something. But we don't have data to back that up. It's just some reason, and if you have any other thing you could use to explain it to us, I would love to hear.
I take the liberty as moderator to ask a question of the panel. Over the next 2 years, I want you to try and put your best guesses forward in terms of what might happen. I think you all realize we're facing a very difficult economic climate where, if anything, there will be greater pressure brought to bear on our health and social service systems with increasing numbers of Americans in fact, losing care, losing income, and the like. You add that to a lively debate that's going on in terms of healthcare reform and what that means. My guess is I think that in some ways puts into jeopardy full funding for the Ryan White Care Act, among other things. But given your areas of interest, if you could share with us what your thoughts in terms of what we might be looking at over the next coming years, couple of years, in terms of the ability to provide comprehensive services, retain patients and care, address issues like stigma, lack of housing, et cetera.
I'll take a stab. It's a pretty loaded question, but I think with some of the points that were brought up by the audience about, I think in the back, about the comorbid issues, talking about the spiraling effect of a poor economy, loss of public programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, California Medi-Cal, and the like, and then programs like Ryan White are also seeing less funding, we're going to have more families and more individuals that are in need of these services with sort of their safety net programs diminishing and eligibility levels being cut down, that we're going to see, I think, even more of a fragmented approach to probably dealing with these needs. In our work, in terms of seeing how the case managers and treatment advocates can sort of try to bring these things together in already fractured systems in some places, that there's probably going to be a greater need for that, and sort of having these advocates that can really help individuals and families navigate what is available for them out there and try to piece something together that addresses both their needs as HIV patients, but also all these comorbid issues that are going on, children, the mental health problems, rehabilitation services, and just your basic economic services for housing, food, shelter, things like that. So I think we're really going to need some strong advocates out there to continue to tie these things together for this population.
And building on that, I'm also afraid that as people get dropped as systems become more fragmented and people get dropped for insurance, we're going to see more people going into emergency rooms rather than getting preventive care, and that's just going to make the cost go up and up and up, unfortunately. Spiraling.
And again, I just think that's just the catalyst for having more people, if not dropping out of care, totally transitioning in and out of care as you choose, you select a therapy, because it's going to come to a point where you're competing with surviving. How much am I going to use to feed and pay my rent and medical bills and other services? And it's just going to get to a point you're throwing up your hands off as a dad and saying, well, I can go without 2 years, and I'm really bad, I'll go,
Thank you all. Any final questions? I'll ask the panel to stay up here for a few minutes if any of you want to discuss anything with them one-on-one. Thank you all for coming. Continuing Ed booth.
Yes, in the main registration area?
Yes.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
No, can you get that?
Okay, so
two of my collaborators of course, yeah.
Yes.
I think the more
I really want to concern that's necessary.
Thank you. Somebody, intermediary. insurance for their services is cheaper than qualified than the husband. So they will come off insurance and go on to ride my Part A.
I would actually add on my earlier comment, which is I would definitely say that would probably be more efficient.
Right.
Because you can get drug treatment, you can get mental health services, you get, there's so many other things with the insurance that you get, that and it just makes you more, it gives you more access to case management,
right.
And there's just all these other things that folks need, especially if you see the indigent folks just need a lot. So.
Well, I think the nice thing is the first thing is it's a challenge, but it has to be a medical case management. You know, if you're hearing they're not those three things, you know, and of course it's 12 months, it doesn't, you can't get reimbursed for it, which has helped a lot. We have a lot of, you know, of course, case management and dry cleaning agencies pop up, you know, because they somehow still think that there's money to be made and they chuck it. And I just think that there's a pot of money that I can, you know, and even if they're good intention, there are some really